Soman Chainani is in the studio with me tonight. He writes and directs films, including Davy and Stu and Kali Ma, and is a recipient of the Sun Valley Writers Fellowship and the Sasha Grant. His first novel, titled The School for Good and Evil, debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list and will be made into a major motion picture. Tonight, we're going to talk about his second novel in the series, which is titled The School for Good and Evil, A World Without Princes.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be
here. Good to see you. So in this series, we have two young women who are at the center, Sophie and Agatha. And if you would, tell us who they are and how they ended up back at the School for Good and Evil.
Sure. So Sophie's entire life is based on this idea that she wants to be a princess. Unlike everyone else in her town who's terrified of being kidnapped to this legendary School for Good and Evil because you never see your parents again, never see your friends again, Sophie has that kind of Disney brainwashing of, oh, being kidnapped is amazing because I'll get to end up that kind of pink princess who has a handsome prince for the rest of my life. And so she ends up getting kidnapped along with Agatha, who is her best friend, who everyone presumes is a witch and going to go to the School for Evil. And in the first book, they get switched. And as a result of kind of their adventures, they discover that good and evil aren't really as black and white as they seem. And the second book brings them back to that school because of some loose ends that have happened in their fairy tale, in which case, even though Agatha has come back with Sophie, her best friend, she's still thinking about the prince she left behind. And so the second book is all about sort of a battle of the sexes as a metaphor for that moment in a middle school girl's life when she has to choose between her best friend and a boy. Because all girls go through that period, I think. And that's what I'm seeing most of the time.
And who is Tedros?
And Tedros is the prince between them. You know, he's the prince that Sophie always thought was hers. He's the son of King Arthur. Both his parents are dead at this point, has all the money in the world, and, you know, is basically going to be king. And all he wants is a girl who actually likes him for who he is. And so when he meets Sophie, who wants him for his money and his crown, you know, his instinct is ultimately to go towards Agatha. And so it becomes this kind of triangle between them.
I understand that in undergraduate school, you wrote your thesis on the fact that evil women make such irresistible villains. So do you have further thoughts about that? Why do you think that is?
Growing up, I had seen all the Disney movies, and there's 57 animated movies, and only 7 have females. But those are the only ones anybody actually cares about. You know, and even the ones you might cite, like Aladdin and Lion King, as ones that broke through. But those men act like women, I think. Like Jafar and Scar have very feminine kind of slinky qualities to them. So I just was like, why is it that a female is so much more terrifying? And you realize it's because they can't rely on guns. They can't rely on brute strength. They can't rely on like some big army. It's always manipulation and seduction and intelligence. And that was the number one thing. And then I think the second thing is, you know, when you say woman in a fairy tale and you think of the hero, they're always very warm, maternal figures. And then what makes the women so irresistible as villains is all the maternity is drained out of them. And if you look at the original Grimm stories, what made those villains so scary to kids, the stepmother, is that the stepmother was willing to trade her own well-being for the kids. So like in Hansel and Gretel, the story nowadays is, say there was a family of 4, 2 parents, 2 kids. If the parents can't afford the kids, the parents starve. They'll do anything they can to feed the kids. That's not what the stories were like in the 1800s. It was, you know, the stepmother comes in, they no longer can feed the kids, and so she plots to get rid of them. And she convinces the father, we can have our happy life together, let's get rid of the kids. And so that's what was read to these kids at an early age. And I think what it sort of taught them is, at some point, you have to become independent. You have to trust yourself, because you can never always rely on adults. It was this bigger metaphor for life. At some point, you are responsible for your own food, you know, and your own life.
Which was true in those days.
Absolutely.
Life much harder in many ways. So you have talked about Disney movies, which is interesting that you grew up with that cultural influence. And I know that your parents are from India.
Yes.
And you have lived in various places around the world. So before we went on the air tonight, we were talking a little bit about cultural influences on you in terms of writing this book and your interest in fairy tales. So say a little bit about that, particularly the British experience.
growing up, I only watched Disney. I mean, we didn't have TV, we didn't have cable, we didn't have internet. So that was my exposure to stories, to storytelling in general, was Disney. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time in London as well. And that's sort of where I kind of had a formative influence in kind of learning about the Grimm stories. And so that gap of seeing the Disney movies and then all the stories that sort of the British kids were reading, the original versions of like The Little Mermaid and Cinderella, where nothing ends happily and everybody's miserable at the end because of bad choices. And the same choices that the Disney characters made and yet ended up happy forever, sort of created that gap. And what I realized is I just preferred the original stories because they made kids kind of think about how to survive on their own. And the fairy tales were almost like survival guides to life. And the bigger thing I realized, just from a commercial point of view, was those stories had bigger audiences. You know what I mean? Like the original Little Mermaid, the original Cinderella were stories that you could tell a 6-year-old, and there were stories you could tell a 26-year-old, and they would elicit the same kind of terror and fear, and they would stay with you your whole life. And I felt like the Disney stories had become almost exclusively, you know, with a few exceptions, for young kids. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to do with The School for Knievel was bring fairy tales back to everyone and be able to tell a story that an 8-year-old could get the basic storyline and then older audiences could get everything underneath. And it was a point of contention with the publisher because when I was done, they were like, what age is this for? I was like, what do you mean what age is this for? It's for everybody. They're like, no, there's only two groups. There's middle grade and there's young adult. And I was like, well, it's for both. They were like, you have to choose.
And for older adults, I will confirm that, definitely. I think that's always true of great children's literature. It isn't fixed at one age.
Yeah, of course.
You have a writer's statement that intrigued me, and I'll just read it. It's brief. Young readers especially learn that to be on one side in any of these battles means they cannot be on the other. Audiences of all ages discover the school for good and evil is to see them awaken to the space between these sides. Mm. So talk about the space between, because I think that also, in my mind, connects up with these deeper issues that you've been talking about, where we don't just plaster over
right,
and everybody ends up happily ever after.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think one of the problems with the way technology is going is everything becomes visual stimulation, right? And especially with adults, it gives you this idea that you see something on a screen and it gives you this kind of instant erotic charge, and that becomes your stimulation in life, and you're just constantly looking for that high. And I always thought that you get rid of that, and that was the whole point of fairy tales in the 1800s, was you get rid of that by showing the subtext, right? Mm-hmm. That the actual fairy tale loses its power once you see what it's really about, which is why the Disney stories are so counterproductive in a way. So ultimately, what I wanted to do with the three books was take two set of binary terms that we think we know and then use the book to kind of play with the space between so that by the end, kids no longer even know what the words mean. So the first book, by the end of the book, kids have no idea who's good and evil anymore, and they've completely lost faith in both those terms. Second book, which is my favorite, I think, of the two, just because we play with boy and girl, and those are almost harder to blow up. But by the end of the book, you know, it's the same thing. The kids have lost all conception of what the stereotypes of a boy and a girl are, and at some point are confused who is even a boy or girl anymore. And the third book's going to be about young and old. And so it's taking kind of fairy tale magic to reclaim terms that we've kind of just crystallized and left there.
Well, fascinating to read, and it's delightful to talk with you about it. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks so much. It was great.
I've been talking with Soman Chainani about his latest book, which is titled The School for Good and Evil, A World Without Princes. You'll find more information at wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Barbara Gray.